that day I walked out of prison, I understand what freedom was and how precious it was and why people died for it. And it's something I've held on to since then.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and I am so excited to share our guest with you today. His name is Gary Buechler, and he is well known for his pop culture commentary. He's seen on shows like Piers Morgan. He's also frequently on YouTube and Rumble, where millions of fans flock to hear his every un-PC opinion. But few know the dark road he traveled to become a voice of nerd culture. In his own words, Gary said, "Before I was Nerdrotic, the name of his channel, I was just Gary, a guy who slept beneath a bush in front of a Long John Silver's." He added, "I'm proof that even when you're down and out, you can turn your life around if you're willing to change." Now, for the first time, Gary is sharing his entire story, and he's here to talk to us about his book today, Waiting for Nerdrotic, which chronicles his early drug abuse instances rehab, as well as his experiences with homelessness and incarceration. Gary Buechler, welcome to the Daily Helping. It is awesome to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me on. Thanks for reminding me of all that stuff.
You guys sent it to me, so I only read what people send me. But I love stories like this, right? Because, you know, they're redemption stories. I think, what was it in the second Batman, right? Was it Everybody Loves a Redemption Story?
I think they do. You've been in and around recovery. You're aware of like how the dangers of ego, the dangers of ego in recovery. So I just try to like check myself and go, this is just one story out there that I've told many times in AA meetings that I hope people find inspirational and hope show that basically if an idiot like me can drag himself out from homelessness and get past prison and go from literally nothing, like I had $200 and am able to like lead a really just mediocre life, that's fantastic. And that's, you know, what's happened with YouTube later has been extraordinary, and I'm really grateful for it. But I was pretty happy with my mediocre life. I was very happy with it because I didn't think I was going to have that at all. And maybe I think the best thing is my grading curve, that like whenever I get bummed out, I still get bummed out, you know, Dr. Richard, I get sad. But I always, you know, I've got this grading curve of like, well, I'm not in prison right now. This is better than prison. And that's gotten me through bankruptcies. That's got me through a lot of stuff, just the mindset. But the story is, I mean, there's more extraordinary stories out there, but it is one that when people have heard it in my AA meetings in the past, they're like, you should write a book. I'm like, I don't know how to write, you know, and I had to have help doing it. But it's when I went through the process of writing the book and I had a lot of help, it did bring a lot of stuff up that, you know, I had dealt with in meetings and therapy and with my sponsor, but stuff I haven't thought about in a couple of years, maybe. And it was rough. It was really rough to go through some of that, especially when my wife was sitting right next to me for a lot of this stuff, and she had a front row seat for much of this, for a lot of this, and it was hard for us to go over again, but I'm glad we did. And outside of hurting other people, I wouldn't change the path because I'm grateful for everything I've learned. And being homeless is not fun, and it makes you appreciate shelter a lot more in the process of getting shelter. And through losing freedom, I actually learned what liberty meant. It's something I think, well, I took for granted. I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but I took completely for granted. But that day I walked out of prison, I understand what freedom was and how precious it was and why people died for it. And it's something I've held on to since then. And I always mark my anniversary of walking out of prison. That's a big day for me, kind of like my AA birthday. And I just want to like maybe pass on to somebody if they get, you know, for one, they'll get a lot of laughs at my expense in this book. But if they learn that, you know, it's easy to say, well, if you just try, you can do it. It's really hard. It was really, really hard, Dr. Richard. And we have to make that clear, but it's not as hard as dying or going to jail.
And I will say this, I mean, we got to chat just for a few minutes before we hit the red button here today. And, you know, I just appreciate your humility. But I also think you're maybe underselling what you've accomplished, because it's, I know, because I've worked for years with people struggling with addiction, and for greater than probably 85% of them, it is a revolving door. And it's, you know, sober for 6 weeks and right back where they started. So let's do this. So we've teased a lot, both in the intro and from what you've said. So let's jump in the Gary Buechler time machine. Talk to us about how we got where we were. Like you teased, there was addiction and the homelessness. So where were you before that and what led to it?
I'm adopted, and my parents were very middle-class, normal parents, really good parents. I've never blamed them for anything. They never abused me. They were kind, made sure I went to school, make sure I was fed. I had an older sister. My dad never missed my baseball games. Pretty normal life. Pretty normal life. I think, for one, I was born an addict. I think it was hereditary. Now that I know my birth mother, I know a little bit about the family, and there's alcoholism and drug addiction in the family. So I'm pretty sure I was born addicted. Also, what didn't help, I was abused by a teacher in elementary school. And through that abuse, I was a bad student and they flunked me. So I repeated second grade. So after that, never trusted authority, never did well in school, was not made for school anyway. But that certainly didn't help. Now, occasionally, if I had a good teacher, I would probably get an A in that class, but that was like twice. And I was, you know, I hung around at school and did my thing until I discovered drugs. So I just kind of went through, I was pretty much a C student, and it never excited me. I was always into comic books and science fiction and Star Trek from a little kid, and that was way more interesting to me. And I just couldn't wait to get out of school and do all that stuff. But it was pretty normal. I was unextraordinary as a student, but it was pretty normal. But then when I found drugs at a very early age, I started drinking when I was 11 and 12. By 13, by junior high, we didn't have juice boxes. We had high C juice jars. I was stealing vodka from my parents or from my sister, my older sister who was drinking, and filling them halfway up. And I was in junior high, I was getting drunk pretty much every day. And then I graduated to pot. Well, pot was there, but then I graduated to crank, which was big in Southern California where I grew up at the time. So it wasn't coke. Nobody could afford coke, but crank was making its rounds in the early 80s down in Southern California. And it was pretty cheap and it was pretty easy to get. And yeah, it was like, I was buying it from my fellow 13 or 14 year old dealer at junior high. And it was off to the races. I love that stuff. Somehow I managed to make it through a couple years of high school. I did get kicked out of three high schools, San Diego High School, Sunset High School, and Carlsbad High School. And pretty much ran around with a bunch. I was a little punk rocker at the time. We ran around with the punk rockers and the skinheads and the metalheads and the gangbangers, and we'd party all day, all night. I'd hold jobs here and there, but I'd eventually get fired or just leave because of my drug abuse. Started stealing a lot to support my drug abuse. Started like breaking into cars. Then it turned into breaking into houses. I was kicked out of my home at about the age of 15, and I would break into my dad's motorhome at the storage lot to sleep there. I would sleep at the under the bush at the Long John Silver's. I would find places just all over Encinitas to sleep where there. And this is a sleepy little beach town, nice little beach town, Dr. Richard, that they didn't have homeless people there. So I'd have to hide. Sometimes I'd hide near the illegal immigrants, their encampments. I'd sleep wherever I could. I'd sleep at friends' house. Eventually, all my stealing and robbing got me locked up a couple times. I got locked up a lot for like little jail stints. Then I did a year in county for a burglary. I got out of the Ura County, was sober for about a week. Then I started partying again. And then within months, I was in prison, a 4-year sentence for breaking into a house when somebody was home doing a hot prowl. So that's a first degree burglary. And that was my second first degree burglary, which earned me a 4-year sentence. Fortunately, they do half time in prison. And that's how I got in the prison. Then the first time I got really into recovery was right before I went to prison. My dad put me in the Betty Ford Center. So that's where it kind of seeped into my head. And I learned what 12-step was and Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't really start sinking in until in prison. I would just go to the meetings to get out of the cell. And I wasn't going to church, so I go to meetings because I at least recognized those. And it started working. I decided I didn't want to be here anymore. I didn't ever want to come back. And that's where the recovery seeped in. Got out of prison, got married, got divorced, was sober this whole time, got married again, moved up to San Francisco, relapsed while I owned the comic store. And that's really, I obviously needed to do more work. The reason I relapsed, no sponsor, stopped going to meetings, you'll hear this a lot, and was forced to sell my store. My wife and my was like, you're not coming home, put me in a sober living environment, which usually doesn't work, but it worked with me. And I have been sober ever since. I started a podcast for fun, just to have a hobby, because I remember things from being clean before. It's exercise, have a hobby, have a job of any kind. Just keep yourself busy, go to a lot of meetings. And I did that, and I've been sober ever since.
How long have you been sober?
I've been sober almost 13 years.
Congratulations. That's awesome. You know, and again, this is a lot of times it's environment, right? So you can go to a sober living environment, or, you know, the clinical term we use is a controlled environment, right? And so, but then people go back and it's the same old friends and the same old this and the same old that. What do you think it was the last time, 13 years ago, that made you say, I'm done with this crap forever?
The thing was, my kids are going to grow up without a dad. Hell no. I'm not going to do that to my kids. Like, the thought of like not being able to live with my boys was just heart-wrenching in a way I've never felt before. Like, before, when I was out there using, there was no kids involved, so it was just me. But when I started thinking about, like, hey, I don't want to be that absentee dad, and it's not a pride thing, it's like, I don't want to do that to them. And hopefully we can work out the marriage. Wasn't looking good at the time, but that's what motivated me. And I know it's supposed to be my sobriety, and that comes above all else, and it does. It does. But what you asked, what motivated me was, there's no way I was not going to be in my kid's life.
We talk about things being protective factors, right? Risk factors and protective factors. But for me, it's what's the most important thing. And for you, that was the most powerful motivating factor, was you didn't want your kids to grow up without a dad, which I love. How old are your boys now?
30 and 19.
30 and 19. Okay.
We have a very good relationship. So
that's great.
Thank God.
Yeah, no, I mean, it could have very easily gone a different way. And for many people, it does. So kudos to you that was the wake up call you needed. And now the YouTube channel. So I know you started the podcast. I presume it was a comic book of sorts related podcast that evolved into the YouTube channel.
Yes, it was just a dumb podcast that I started with my friend Dennis. We recorded our first episode in a Starbucks in West Portal, San Francisco. West Portal is a place where the train stops, basically. It's a nice little part of town. And we recorded in there for about an hour. We had done podcasts at the comic shop, so it was kind of a continuation of that. But that was the first one. It was an hour, and we stuck to it. It was just a dumb little hobby. Like I said, we did. It was on, what was it? It was like podcast.com. It doesn't exist anymore, but that's where we would upload it. We would just record the audio and didn't expect anybody to listen. We did it twice a month for 2 or 3 years. And I started archiving it on YouTube. That's where it was just like, YouTube wasn't even a factor in it. It was just like, I want to keep the recorded, you know, just for future. But I was thinking more of like, well, we'll get in the podcast, we'll get into iTunes or something like that. It never crossed my mind that it would make money. It was just to be fun. And then it changed.
At some point, right? Because there was a bit of accidentally successful on purpose, right? Like, it, you know, mine was pretty similar, right? I did this podcast. I never thought anybody would listen to it. And my stroke of luck was a journalist from NBC found it. And I did an article at NBC.com about what happens to your brain when you watch football games. And the next day, like, everybody on earth was listening to the show that I never thought it would be that, you know? And so at what point did you start figuring out that this channel could really be something spectacular?
When it started getting fun. It was fun to begin with, but it was, we were just kind of working out. We were using Audacity to record. Like, it was a mess. But when we started doing live streams pretty regularly, I was looking forward to it. And the more I looked forward to it, the more I'd prepare for it. I took it as seriously as somebody would take a garage band back in the day. But I've always loved radio. I've always loved everything about radio. I never thought I'd be a DJ because I didn't go to school for it. And there was so much gatekeeping. But I'm like, well, this is the closest I'll ever get. So when we started doing these podcasts, I just started doing more work. And I'm a nerd anyway. So a lot of the work, and I'm doing air quotes right now, was stuff I was doing every morning. I would check Hollywood Reporter, Deadline. These are all the sites I went to. Comic Book Resources when it didn't suck. And Screen Rant when it didn't suck. And all those great nerd sites when they didn't suck. And I read them every day, no matter what. I did that at the comic store. I did that when I wasn't at the comic store. So I was pretty well informed because I've been immersed in this stuff my entire life. But mostly when it finally started taking off was when, God, I hate to use A Star Is Born, like the fourth Star Is Born, the one with Lady Gaga in it. It's actually a really good movie. And towards the end, when she's about to take off in her career, Bradley Cooper's character is like, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to want to change you in the music industry. You just got to find your voice. Got to find your voice. And it's like kind of cliche in the movie, but I kind of listened to that. And I stopped worrying what people thought about me and just saying, talk to how I would talk a customer, to how I'd talk to any friend of mine. And it started picking up then and got more fun. And I try not to question it too much because I have so much fun doing this all the time that I'm afraid if I try to figure out what it is, I might break it. But like when I started taking it seriously, and it was around, I was working at Tesla at the time. It was around Doctor Who. And I got a shout out from Dave Cullen at the time, which really kind of boosted the channel. It was huge to get a shout out from him. And I'm always grateful for that. All of a sudden, like my views and my subs were just shooting up astronomically after just being at about 1,000 subs for years. Years and years and years. And once I saw this opportunity, I told my wife, bless her, I said, you know, I think we got something here. And like, I had no business quitting at the time. Let's just say it. Like, I think I made $1,000 after denying that I'll ever make money on it ever. The first time I make $1,000, I'm like, I'm going to give this a shot. So I told my wife, I'm like, I'm going to give this a shot. And if it doesn't work in 6 months, I'll just go find another job because I have a skill where I can pretty much, you know, giving up the Tesla job kind of suck, good benefits, but we did it. And within a month, the channel tripled in size when I was able to focus on it full time and had the time of my life doing it.
There's a gazillion shows out there that are talking about the latest episode of, you know, Alien Earth or whatever, whatever's out, right? Why do you think your channel resonates with millions of people? Like, you know, you've got one of the largest channels in this space. What do you attribute that to?
My guess would be, I mean, because the audience has to speak for themselves, but my guess would be being honest. Rigorous honesty is something we talk about a little bit in recovery, and just all my criticism still, like, I love this stuff. I've always loved this stuff. I hate what I've seen happen to the stuff I love. And I think a lot of other people felt that way too. And then it formed into a, I hate the word community. That's why I call it the fellowship. That's got a double meaning because, you know, Lord of the Rings and recovery. And it created a fellowship of people who've, like, I've now administered a wedding. Like, people have met, dated, and broke up in our chats. And we do meetups. And it's just, it's kind of what fandom used to be. And that's the most important part, is these people of the audience that I share with. It's not mine. They've found each other. And now they're starting channels too. I think it's great. I think it's great for culture. I think it's great for fandom. But the God, why? I am an idiot with a microphone. And if I could do it, anybody can do it. And I think, you know, like, once that's established, once that's established that I'm going to make mistakes, honestly, that's another thing I try not to think of too much. So it doesn't, like, make the head get too big. But I would say the thing I heard the most is authenticity. I think that's really important. But that's across the board. That's just not with me. That's with you. That's with Joe Rogan. That's with anybody doing podcasts now. The best ones are the authentic ones.
Hey, guys. Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I think it's interesting, too. You're saying things, and I'm just comparing you to some of the other people I've had on my show. There's a spirit of entrepreneurship in you, and you don't really talk about it in those terms, or at least we haven't. But I mean, I've had people on my show who are the serial entrepreneurs that go and do all these things. And kind of the common thread between them is they found something that really is who they are. Like, it resonates at a soul level with who they are. It's incredibly rewarding for them. It helps other people. But probably the most important element that those people have shared with me in terms of being successful is they're not afraid to make mistakes. And failing is a gift, actually. So, you know, I hear that you call yourself an idiot with a microphone, but you're doing what you love, just cavalierly. And you're doing it with your friends. That, like, what's cooler than that, right?
And thousands of people join us. That will never not be amazing, right? And I'll be grateful for it. I mean, we could be really dumb on that show, but it's so much fun and we're laughing. I can't tell you how many shows where I was done and my face hurt. I was laughing so much. And the chat is actually, they are way funnier than we are. And it's great enjoying having that interactive experience. And then it's even better that it's my job. The entrepreneurial thing, yeah, failing is, I think it's great, especially when it's not as bad as I failed in the past. So I have failed so hard in the past. It's like, you know what? If one video doesn't do so well, or I accidentally misspell a title, who cares? You know, and I screw up all the time on a live stream. Plus, that's an impossible feat to think, I'm going to go on a live stream for 3 or 4 hours and not make a single mistake. Get out of here. You're going to make mistakes and just go, you know what? I messed that one up. Whoops, sorry. You know, that's all you do. And I think you can't be afraid to fail at all, especially those of us who have failed so much. We will fail again. The YouTube works because I've got this like magpie ADHD thing, but it really works for YouTube. Because I don't have to have the set schedule. And then because I don't have the set schedule, I don't know if this makes any sense to you. I'm still working on it all the time, but I can also get up and work at 2 o'clock in the morning if I need to. I can like at any time. It makes vacationing hard with the family, but we figured it out. I just take my equipment with me. And if I need to record a video, I'll rent an extra hotel room and record a video in there real quick, which I've done many times. And that way I'm still doing, I learned this from my dad, who died early, but who worked his ass off, but always vacationed, always made sure to have some fun at the same time to have that work-life balance, which is tough in YouTube, but it's worked. Even if I tried to like lay it down on like a business plan, it'd be impossible. It'd be impossible to describe how I do things.
It's like the guy whose desk is total chaos and you'd walk in and it makes no sense to an outsider, but the person knows where everything is and how everything fits together. I totally get it.
That's the system. The meme, you know, the meme from Always Sunny. You know, that's the with the pins. Yeah, that's me.
So the book is coming out and we'll have a link to the book in the show, which goes through the trials and tribulations. I know in greater detail, you know, as we flash forward, right, we went back in time. Now we're going to take the DeLorean forward a little bit. Where do you see this going? Like, what do you think this looks like in 5 years?
As far as the channel or culture?
What you're doing. I want to talk about the culture separately.
Okay. So me in 5 years, I never think that far ahead. I'm very much in the here and now. In 5 years, I hope I'm still doing this I don't know, maybe a little different. If you ask me what I'd love, I'm a big Art Bell fan. I'm a big fan of Art Bell, one of the greatest radio announcers ever. And I think if somebody asked me, hey, what's your retirement job? Because I'm 56 now. I'm not that close to retirement. But if somebody asked me, like, what's my retirement job? If I got to talk, we were just talking about this before the podcast. If I got to talk about UFOs and Bigfoot and ancient civilizations like every night, 5 nights a week, I'm good. That's where I'd love to be. And I'd do that one until I die.
So I want to talk about the culture piece because it's so interesting. And I've had a guy on very early on in my show named Bob Berg, and he was kind of an outcast in the corporate space because he talked about businesses should have a purpose that helps mankind, not just to make cash. And everybody, you know, he got the scarlet letter, and now the pendulum has kind of shifted and everybody realizes that that guy was a genius and people want to work where they feel like they're contributing to something good and that makes them happy. There are a lot of people on the internet, and I know you don't care. In fact, I think it feeds you, but there are a lot of people that absolutely can't stand you and say all kinds of, you're a toxic human being and you're, you know, destroying civilization and, you know, Antichrist and all of these lovely epitaphs about you. But I know you didn't start out trying to do that either. Like, you were just trying to make a show about pop culture and comic books. So talk to us about how this all evolved and that, I mean, now you're going on Piers Morgan on a regular basis talking about, you're not talking about comic books when you're on Piers Morgan, right? You're talking about cultural issues. So how did that evolve for you?
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, the show started out essentially as we were going to live react to TV shows. We saw this golden age of TV coming in, the streaming prestige series. We're like, man, we're going to get a lot of good stuff. Little did we know, we were sweet summer children at the time, but Game of Thrones was still around and there were some good movies. So we just live reacted to shows that other people weren't. I just wanted to be different. So like Ash versus Evil Dead or Westworld when it was starting, American Gods. And it was just fun. And, you know, again, we weren't making any money off it. But then we started doing like a general show, which turned into Friday Night Tights. So it started on Friday many, many years ago, where we just talk about the news of the week. We'd wrap up the news of the week and we review a movie that we saw on a Thursday preview or something like that. And it was fun. But I started noticing stuff culturally going on in comic books and in games and in publishing and other, like a lot of other people were doing that, were noticing this. You know, there was Gamergate, which has a stigma, but at its core, it was gamers were not happy with games journalism and they saw the activism creeping into their hobby. We had the sad puppy incident in publishing, which was basically Gamergate, the same core, which is activism getting involved in publishing. We had the early days of Comicsgate when it was a consumer movement. It was activists invading a popular hobby and mistreating the customers. And then Hollywood started doing it. And it really kind of kicked off with Ghostbusters 2016, where they literally started attacking the fans. Like, people from the show were attacking fans, were calling fans ist and phobe and all that. And it got worse with The Last Jedi. I came in with at Last Jedi and Doctor Who, and I started calling this stuff out. I'm like, you know, fandom, it's not like we've all gotten along all the time, but we were always a pretty friendly place. You know, like, sure, the furries were off in the corner at the con and we tried to ignore them as much as we could. But everybody else, I always give this example. In my store, we had my good friend, William Selby, who is a conscientious objector, former hippie, left guy, with my father-in-law, who went to Vietnam and flew helicopters and delivered beer and picked up bodies. And they were getting along great in the comic store talking about Tintin. They were talking about Tintin, how much they love Tintin. And I'm like, that's what fandom's supposed to be. And now they poisoned the well by making half of the fandom evil because they supported Trump or they like a meme or whatever. And we started seeing this creep into forums. It's crept into everything we love. And it just got insane. And like, I thought it was bad in 2017, 18, and 19, and it got so much worse culturally. So I just kept talking about like what I was seeing from my point of view. And it just so happened that a lot of people were seeing the exact same thing at the exact same time. Other channels, other people out there. The thing I hear the most at meetups was, I thought I was alone. I thought I was going crazy. And I'm like, so did I. So did I. I thought like, maybe I'm just an old man yelling in a cloud, you know, and this is just nothing. But now that we've seen the end result and where we are now, it's a good thing people were calling it out, or maybe it wouldn't have changed and we dodged a bullet. Some people might not agree, but we had a cultural shift in November. It wasn't just a presidential election. It was a dam breaking because the institutions, which can be a private one, that were involved with our entertainment, our information, were holding culture back. They were trying to force a culture on us that we didn't want. I think his last name is Fink from BlackRock. He's the one who came out and said, we're going to start forcing behaviors. Like, these are things they have been saying openly recently with a game called Take Us North. They admitted that the game was, it's an immigrant, well, I'll just say illegal alien simulator. And they said, we made it as propaganda, right? So now they're just coming out and admitting it. And the only thing I was doing was calling this out and saying, hey, this makes our stories really bad, for one. And you're also alienating half of America, half of your potential customers. And this is not sustainable. And it turns out it wasn't in the end. And I lost friends along the way. I lost friends over who I voted for, my COVID stance, my stance on kids. You know, I'm a father. I'm very protective of children. And I've lost a lot of old friends based on the politics changing around me. I was never a Republican or Democrat. I've always been an independent, and I wasn't able to vote until very recently because I'm a felon. So I never really cared. But when it started interfering with my life directly, shutting down my wife's business during COVID, you could say I got radicalized. But I got radicalized to common sense, which we have been bleeding in this country. And it's nice to see it somewhat come back. And it's nice to see the people who fought against it so long lose, to be honest with you. Because they were pretty brutal. They needed to be humbled. And I think that's what's happening now. I don't think it's over, but culturally, at least we had a victory. I won't say we won the war. There is a culture war going on, and it will continue to go on. And I think it'll always go on. But I think we at least won a battle, and more people are aware. And, you know, when simple things happen, like Sydney Sweeney wears some jeans and people freak out, and then you see the reaction to that is like, stop being an idiot. It's just a girl in jeans. That's where we win, you know, and that's why it's always been bigger than Star Wars. It's always been bigger than Marvel. It's always been bigger than Star Trek, the things I talk about, right? Because the seeds of those things failing were really the seeds of our culture failing.
I remember the Ghostbusters thing when that happened, because you would see the cast. I remember seeing the tweets, and they were viciously attacking fans. And that was the first time, like, wow, like, they are really, you know, business 101 is don't alienate half of your customer base. And it was interesting too, you know, like when The Last Jedi came out. So I was brought onto a Star Wars podcast to talk about the psychology of fandom. And so even then, like, there was a guy who, so I was talking about it, and, you know, it's like the analogy I made was, as a Star Trek guy, like, you know, you can say, okay, Star Trek 2 was incredible, Star Trek 5 was garbage. And like, if you like Star Trek 5, I mean, there's probably something wrong with you, but like, I can respect you as a human being, and that's okay. But we got so polarized to where, I mean, there was a guy in the chat room. I was saying, and, you know, I'm pretty close in age to you, so I grew up with Star Wars. Like, that was my whole childhood. And, you know, there was a guy in the chat room who was saying to me, you know, I want to fight you. I want to kill you. You know, and that was, you know, I've been exposed, obviously, as a clinician who's worked in inpatient mental health facilities. I've seen psychopathology, right? I've never seen it in that setting, right? In the real world, where you're just, it should be just a talk about movies. And there was somebody who, you know, because I said I didn't like The Last Jedi, and I argued that, you know, unlike the original trilogy that really articulated the hero's journey, that, you know, the new movies to that point had just been hot garbage, and there was really no direction with any of it. There was literally a guy, you know, banging on his keyboard who, if he could have grabbed me by the throat, would have. And so I just think it's interesting. And the data shows, not so much with that, but on the social media side of the house, it was really the election that was Clinton and Trump. That was the first time that we actually saw, based on data, there were large numbers of people who would disassociate with somebody else if you voted for Hillary, I can't be friends with you. Oh, you voted for Trump, I can't be friends with you, right? And so this was the first time we actually saw in mass numbers where society was taking sides. No other election in history had showed that, right? Like, you know, you might not have liked George W. Bush, or you might have, you know, you might not have liked Al Gore, but you could talk to the day after the election was over. You know, if you had a sign in your yard for one candidate and your next door neighbor had one for the other candidate, you could hang out and have a beer and grill burgers the next week and everything was okay. It's really, I recently did an episode where I had a very well-known judge and, you know, somebody who ran political ad campaigns, and one was on the left and one was on the right, and their whole platform is what's great about America. The discourse, the ability to have the discourse is what's great about America. And I feel, you know, to your point, like there are people, there is a culture war, but I think it feels like the discourse, and I'm not talking about the outliers on either side, I feel like there's more of a gravitas towards the middle, and that people can start having conversations that I don't think we've been able to have those conversations in a while. And that's healthy, because the analogy of your father-in-law, who served during Vietnam and the conscientious objector, being able to hang out and talk about Tintin. I hope not the Spielberg Tintin. I hope the original Tintin.
The original Tintin.
Okay, yes. Much better. Yeah, like that's healthy, right? So
yeah,
I love that you're out there doing what you're doing. And I know you take some arrows, right? But
and that was the whole point of it when I was calling it out earlier, was things are getting so divisive. We don't need Hollywood piling on, which they did. And they made it worse. Social media made it worse. The news made it worse. And I do think we're at a point now where people are just sick of it. For one, the fringes right now culturally are splitting up. They're fracturing.
Yeah, they are.
Right? They're starting to fracture. And I think more people in the middle are just going, F this. You know, even, you know, Bill Maher coming out going like, I'm not going to demonize anybody who voted for Trump. That's, I don't agree on Bill Maher on much, but that's great that he said that, you know, and it's great that Piers says that. So when more people say that have bigger voices out there, I think that's what we hope. I would love for us to just be talking about like some semi-decent movies once in a while. That'd be great. That's what I hope for someday.
Gary, I've loved every minute of our conversation today. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question. What is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after you're hearing our conversation today?
Gratitude is what got me, really clicked for me in my second stint in sobriety, and what gets me through like stressful, anything I feel stressed during the day. I do stop myself now, and I'll make a little mental note in my head that was burned into me by my sponsor through 90 days. He made me do 90 meetings in 90 days when I relapsed, and I had to make a gratitude list every night and talk to him every night, and it burned in my head, and it works. And I'm like, okay, what am I grateful for today? And I just think of a couple things, and it helps. It's a mindset, right? And I think I did that even when things weren't great, and it worked. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's the thing that clicked for me in recovery that made it work to this very day, by the grace of God.
Gary, tell us where people, well, you're on YouTube, so tell us the name of the channel. The book is Waiting for Nerdrotic, and we'll have a link to that, as I said, in the show notes. But tell us where people can check out all your content.
You can find me at Nerdrotic on YouTube, Nerdrotics with a plural on Twitter, and Nerdrotic on Instagram.
Perfect. And again, we'll have everything linked to not only the book, but the YouTube channel, Instagram, the whole nine yards at the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, this has been awesome, Gary. Thanks for joining us today. Excited about the book, and hope we connect again.
I hope we can too. Thanks, Dr. Richard.
Absolutely. And to each and every one of you who took time out of your day to listen to this, thank you as well. If you liked it, if you're inspired, if you're going to go grab this book and learn about Gary's journey, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your social media feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.